After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Mind Rolling. Raghu, I am back here with David Harshada. Harshad. We're just getting the pronunciation correct after all these years, Wagner. And we're also saying that it's been quite a while since we've done a podcast together. And but at the same time, we're living in the same town, so we do see each other, although it's sparing now because of COVID. And in reality, I could be in Russia and he could be in, you know, Estonia, maybe. Thinking of them. So, anyway, welcome, David.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. We haven't been together in a while. It's like, okay, what have you been up to?
I know.
What are you doing in the midst of the pandemic, quarantine, non-quarantine, back to quarantine, vaccines, all of it?
Yeah. Have you had COVID? We actually all had it.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Rachel told me that. Wow.
Yeah. Adriana and I and both kids had it. We went back to New York and I think we got it there. So we went through that little bit of odyssey. Luckily, we both had mild symptoms and the kids basically had no symptoms.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm teaching a lot. I'm not traveling, which is very different. You know, before COVID, I was on a plane somewhere at least once a month. So taking that out of the thing, I'm painting, I'm making art, I'm teaching a lot, I'm working on a new book. I'm in a way, I don't like to use the word busy, but the tempo of my work is very up tempo these days.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing the potential grace that does come from not floundering in the habitual patterns that we have been used to.
Yeah.
For so long. And then you're able to take a look at that and go, wow, that's interesting. Yeah. And then you clearly see the escape mechanisms. It's funny. Yeah. This is so dumb, but I'm going to share it because I already have shared it. But I did a podcast quite some time ago with a psychologist from Canada, psychiatrist, who's also an expert at addiction, and whose name is escaping me this moment, but you guys are going to find it and put it up in the show notes, and I'm sure I'll remember.
Probably a Gabar Mate.
Yeah, see? What would I do without you? An embarrassing moment. Senior moment. So basically, he said, you know, talking addiction isn't, I mean, obviously, heroin and cocaine and alcohol are major addictions where the detox on all of them is horrible. Mm. But there's another addiction. He said, well, we're talking about everybody's got it. It's addiction to sex. It's addiction to workaholics, all the way down to that, whatever. And we all know we've all got them. And he talked about how they stemmed from childhood, from the causes and conditions through parental care, through school, through teachers, and so on and so forth, and what you came in through karmically. And so he said, do you recall what yours was? I'm being therapized now in a podcast, right? So I said, I had a father that was a bit of a tyrant, and a bit of is not, is an understatement. So I said, the thing that would allow me to release out of that fear that I used to have about getting screamed at and whatever was football. So what happened, I played football, I watched football, and it got so ingrained that the actual, just seeing the green carpet on television is like, I mean, it's, so I told him this, and he said, yeah, absolutely. You were just, that was your defense mechanism and created an addiction. I mean, even today, the Super Bowl was awful, but still, I did watch it. So the way in which we can find that outlet to be comfortable and not defensive is addictions, small and large, right?
Yeah. Which, you know what mine is?
Yeah. I was going to ask.
Cop shows.
Yeah.
I love even like really bad network cop shows. There's something about, 30, 40 minutes and these cases come and the cases get solved and, people are kicking in doors and catching the bad guys and all of that. And there's something about that that's very regulating for my nervous system. After I've spent my whole day meditating and teaching meditation, teaching the scriptures, I like to go and watch cops kick down doors.
Yes, perfect. That's just perfect. And your father's not a policeman.
No, quite the opposite.
That's great. Oh boy. So we're getting a chance, to look at all of this stuff at this time. It's almost a year now, and it's pretty extraordinary. And I brought this up a million times, so people are sick of hearing me say it, but I found this thing somebody had in a blog that was it was a phrase translated from ancient Chinese about these kinds of uncertain, chaotic times. It's called terrifying isn't the right word. Dangerous. I would say dangerously terrifying opportunity. But dangerous opportunity was the way. But in some ways, there has been so much terror. The thing that went on in at the Capitol a month ago, and what's going on right now with the politically and so on, and the divide in the country is so dangerous and sometimes pretty scary, but still an opportunity. And I guess that's what I like to focus on with all of this.
Yeah, I mean, just the uncertainty. There's only, we're wired to need a certain amount of uncertainty or else we get bored. But if we have too much uncertainty, then, it's very dysregulating. And that has been the main predominant thing, especially in this past year, is the whole Trump regime kind of crescendoed and the election and COVID and cyber hacking and all of these things. Like this ever increasing, it's like, welcome to the age of Aquarius. We thought it was going to be like hippies and, dancing naked, and it's
not.
It's like drowning in a swarm of megapixels and, cyber attacks.
really. It's, the Aquarian age. which makes me think of growing up in the 70s, as all of this burgeoned late 60s and 70s when I was a kid and grew into it, and fortunate to spend so much time in India fairly quickly with an incredible being, say the least. And but everything that was going on back then, everything that was being espoused, which now – is basically a lot of people are in denial that it even happened. You know, I mean, the one great thing that's happening is around psychedelics and the way that they're now being used in therapeutic manner is really quite extraordinary. And so, but there is a through line from that period to now, I feel.
And, you know,
obviously psychedelics. I mean, we get so much response from people. Be Here Now, still a popular book. You know, it's the 50th anniversary this year of it. And we get so much feedback, and that's a big part of it. But the other part of it, which is what you and I have been talking about outside of any podcast, is Seva and how that can... I like to think that it's really a seva is not about doing something so for someone else alone. It's not a void. It's a everybody is part. We are interconnected, and the doing of whatever it is that we are doing extricates ourselves so beautifully from the as I've been calling it the movie of me. As Krishnadas coined it, actually. So I, and that's some of the stuff that we've been talking about. And I wouldn't mind you, I mean, again, to quote Ram Dass from the movie Becoming Nobody at one point, which to me is my favorite part. I mean, Becoming Nobody, meaning there's complexity to that, and very rarely do you meet a being that has actually has conquered the war inside of any kind of duality. So, but at the very least, you get to the point where you realize, wow, there is, as Ram Dass says in the movie, what, how long will you keep going on about what do I need? What do I want? It's way more interesting when you start to think outside of yourself and do real service. And, so it, that is such an enhancement of cutting through and transforming this selfness, right? That, the actions are reverberate from he who is serving and who he or she who is being served. Talk about, but I'm talking to somebody who just picked up a pot and mixed up some food and just did it. And it was just talk about that experience a little bit.
Well, yeah. And just to piggyback off what you're talking about, also, I was just talking about this in one of my trainings. That, you know, if we have the great fortune of meeting these like deeply realized beings, sometimes we lose track of how important our middle attainments are, you know, in between being completely lost and being completely awake, you know, and that I was describing it that, you know, for many of us, with cultivation, you know, with sadhana, with years of sadhana in many cases, we at least get to the point where we're like a tea bag, you know, kind of going in and coming out. It's not that we never are nobody. You experience being nobody
for
a minute, for a while, and then all of a sudden we're somebody again. Yeah. And then Ram Dass talks about it in Be Here Now, where he has that that thing of like lovers, you know, that just like melt into each other's arms. And then you pull the face back and you look at each other and you're like, oh yeah. You know, like that we come in and out of that. And I think that that is an advanced way to look at practice. It is like the things that take us into that being nobody, like a dimmer switch, like not necessarily like completely Satori, I'm suddenly nobody, but you know, and Seva is an experience of that where, you know, you go and you stretch across a divide and like a social divide or a human divide, and you go out of your way to offer love to someone in a tangible way. sometimes at your own expense, sometimes at least at your own energetic expense, without expecting reward, which that's a whole other topic, but because there always is a reward. But it just in doing that, it's sort of like I was just listening to this Kabir poem that that said, we come into this world with our fists clenched and we leave this world with our hands open. Referring to like a baby and a corpse, but also referring to the path of sadhana, where, you know, like completely unevolved, we're just, this is me and this is how I am. And that thing is like, it's opaque. And then, you know, gradually that loosens. And seva is like one of the deep practices that can allow us to sort of loosen that a little bit. And, you know.
Yeah. I think we should elucidate becoming nobody a little bit, which you've done to some degree. But, you know, people, what do you mean becoming? You become nobody? What do you not? You do sit there? There's not, you can't do anything because you're a nobody.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get to at least a on the ground kind of idea here, and that is that what's happened is with becoming nobody is becoming less attached to who we think we are, less attached to our thoughts, less attached to the neurotic tendencies and the habitual patterns, and the more that the more less attached that you can get, or that happens, because there's no getting, but there, as as you just said, David, absolutely, sadhana practice allows for the spaciousness to happen, where you unglue a little bit. But so it's becoming nobody is just not believing in your story the way that you normally do. And as that happens, you do what Ram Dass suggested in the film, which is, hey, when is enough enough? You know, of consuming and creating circles of defense mechanisms and cushy, making it, you know, so nothing bad's going to, all of that kind of tunnel vision. So that's what we're talking about. Yes, ultimately, there is a thing of, there is a Neem Karoli Baba that's a realized being that is not involved in polarity. There's no us and them. There's nothing. There's just the water.
And also, like, you know, even that there is still a somebody, at least enough to be a vehicle for grace in that sort of a case. And, you know, like the being nobody, it's not that you're like literally like then blank, you know, like my, I had the great good fortune of seeing my teacher in South India on our last trip to India. Adriana and I went to talk to him, and he just said this one offhand thing about Maya, like the notion of Maya or illusion. He's like, it's not Maya. We say illusion, but it's not illusion. He's like, this is here. You're here. I'm here. This is, he was like tapping a chair or something. This is here. The illusion is the significance that we give to all of this. We can't say that all of this is not real. This is real. What isn't real is the significance that we put onto it. And it's the same thing with, like, you know, we're still going to, you know, our shoe size is not going to change. And our shoe preference might not even change much. You know, one time years ago, I was working in Chicago. And I worked in this used bookstore. And it was one of these scenes where, like, you know, a bunch of people would just hang out all the time. And there was an espresso machine and we would just drink coffee and bullshit all the time. And they called me Gandhi because I was like the only one that was like into Eastern spirituality. They always called me Gandhi. Anyway, and there was this old lady who would like sweep up. And I think she made a living by going into a bunch of different shops in that area of Chicago and just kind of like sweeping up. And so she was there kind of sweeping up in the background. And somehow we started bullshitting about astral projection. Mm. And have you ever done it? Have you ever experienced it? Oh, this time when I was on acid, yeah, this time, you know, whatever. And just as she's sweeping, she looked up and she said, you know what, though? Whenever I come back, my clothes don't fit right.
No.
And then she just went back to sleeping again. She was just some cool, like old Chicago lady.
Really? Oh, that's great.
I haven't thought of that in years. But you know, it's like that's the thing in like how to like hold. And I believe that that's what true sadhana teaches us to do, is not affect a spiritual persona, but allow us to sort of spiritualize our persona in the sense of like, just like you're saying, just like not hold it so tightly and not believe it so fully.
Yeah.
You know, but then, you know, at the end of the day, I'm going to like cop shows and you're going to like the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make us any less Satchitananda. It's just that that's how our little incarnational nugget happens to be packed. You know,
are you kidding? I've got guilt. Like, you know, there's a, you know who Larry David is? Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Sure.
Yeah. I think we even talked. Anyhow, there's one scene where he gets stoned. He's trying to help his father as glaucoma. So he gets him some to help glaucoma, which pot apparently does. Anyhow, he says, well, Larry, you got to smoke. So Larry, oh, I don't want to do, you know, he's like a complete paranoiac no matter what. So he does smoke. And next scene, he's in the bathroom and he's yelling at in the mirror. And he's like, what's wrong with you? Just watching TV all the time. Why don't you read a book? That's where I get to about halfway through the Super Bowl or whatever I'm watching. Yeah. You know, a lot of to me, when you talk about this chair, teacher said, this chair is real. It's not, Maya isn't that this, yeah. It's the relationship and the qualities. And to me, it's the projection, you know, of that we carry with us as we see objects and including, of course, people and everything else, animals. Absolutely everything.
Ideas. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're colored.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. That's why extricating from the story we believe in, or just even realizing, shit, I'm telling myself a bunch of shit. And I have no real idea about these projections. Oh, wait a minute. So then mindfulness comes in, right? Mindfulness practices. So you could get an idea of what the motivations are, what it is you saw that color made you go back to that moment when there was, you know, whatever it may be.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And that's also the birth of, you know, what we call the inner guru, where it's like, that's that part that's there. That's like, I remember the first time I ever met Ram Dass in person, it was in like 2005. And I was interviewing him for some Fakakta magazine at the time that's now gone. But and I asked him, well, what is your practice now? And he said, I sit and I look at the ocean and I am the ocean. And I pay. And then he sort of like, he said, I pay attention to how things are playing in soul land, was the way that he said it.
Really?
And he said, so like right now, I could think, oh, I'm being interviewed for a magazine, like sugar plums. Like, he's like, but I have to be careful because this could be a trap and I could get trapped by this. And I thought that that was such a beautiful articulation of that. Like when we live with grace and we have a relationship with grace, we have a relationship with the guru tattva, the guru principle, then we have that internal guru that gives us that vigilance and can remind us. But here's the thing I always like, is especially as I'm training people to meditate. As soon as you meditate, then you've got the guru and the disciple. The disciple is, I'm going to sit here. I'm going to feel my breath. I'm going to do the mantra. And then the guru is the one that goes, hey, you fell asleep. Go back to the mantra. And what I always say is like, let that guru be the sweetest, most loving inner guru that you can have, where there's no spanking. It's, you know, no, like, what are you doing? You know, you came all this way for this thing and now here you are falling asleep. It's like, come back, come back to bed. It's like a lover. It's like, you don't have to think about all that. Come, Rama, that, come back to that. You know, come back to bed. I'm not done with you yet. Like letting the inner guru be like that, even when we get into our own nonsensical behavior, you know, like the Larry David moment, like, what are you doing? You know, like you're yelling at your kid. He's 8 years old. What are you doing? Mm. You know, like it just be like, no, come on. Hey, come on. Come on, Papa. You know, repeat the mantra, drink some water. You know, and the more that loving vibe can be there, at least for me and for a lot of people that I talk to, that transition of the teabag, you know, in and out of incarnation into nothingness and back into somethingness, and, you know, can be a lot more fluid because we don't feel like we have to go to the woodshed and get beat every time we fuck up. Oh, sorry, I don't know if I can use
profane. Oh my God, no! You'll get mail. It's very, very profane. I would also add to this conversation that none of this is possible. The possibility of opening up a space where when you're talking about inner guru, maybe I'd put a little bit of the word intuition in there, that place where one knows without knowing. But the perspective certainly has to be around where are you standing? Are you standing up in here, as Ram Dass would say? And that's his whole loving awareness. No, stand inside or sit inside that place, which is not coming from mind. Because if it's coming from mind, you know, he used to teach about the witness. But if that witness is coming from a judgmental place, and that's basically what you're saying, this is a place of non-judgment. It's okay. Yeah. We're just human. Yeah. It's okay. Yeah. Just come back. You don't have to get out there and get the horsehair shirt and the whips. Yeah. So I think that from whence we stand, if that's some kind of old English thing, that is super important. What would you say though? Talk about and what you tell students and so on, just around the concept of guru. And and you're introducing, just have that inner guru is a non-judgmental, loving being. How do you relate that to the concept of, like Ram Dass has said, I believe as well, everyone has a specific guru that doesn't necessarily manifest as a physical thing. Maharaji himself said it's not physical, but it is specific. So there's a kind of, how do you address it?
Well, I talk about, you know, in Hinduism, there's this idea of nirguna and saguna. Of nirguna means without form, and saguna means with form. So like Hindus, if they're saguni Hindus, then they have a particular form of God that they relate to, or the goddess, or that's saguna. The nirguna is like the yogis relating to like Brahman, you know, just consciousness. And the guru, you know, in Tantra, what is referred to as guru tattva, the guru principle, it can be both saguna or nirguna. And, you know, for many people, myself included, it's saguna to a point where, you know, you have a guru or you work with a guru, and it can be a real guru or it can be a fake guru. Lots of people relate to the guru tattva through dongi gurus, you know, like gurus that might not actually, they might even be total charlatans. I mean, look at this whole thing that's happened with the Yogi Bhajan and all this. But nonetheless, that guru tattva, that guru principle, that in Tantra is referred to as the Anugrahaika Shakti. It's the grace bestowing power of God is the guru. It's the fifth power of God in that system. And that some people have that, and some people have, and especially a lot of contemporary people, in what I call, this is what I sometimes call the post-patriarchal guru paradigm, which is that, you know, very few of us, you know, in ancient times, there would only be one guru that was even possibly going to come into our karma in a lifetime, because we've lived in some place and there, if there was a master there or there wasn't a master there. And nowadays, many people are going to get the guru tattva almost like a nutrient from many different sources. And that the it's trickier in some ways, and in some ways it's also liberating, because with most guru scenes where there's an actual person there who is trying to be or is said to be or is the embodiment of the guru tattva, there's going to be a scene around them that is, you know, there's always a baby in a bathwater. And that, you know, so anyway, for me personally, at one point it was very saguna. And then at a certain point, it became very nirguna, where I can relate to that guru tattva. And I love it when it manifests in a saguna form. I love Maharaji. I love, you know, my teacher, when, you know, when we're in that vibe together. And I have a great respect for all of the teachers that I've had. But at the same time, to not be bound, to not be bound by it. You know, perfect example are like Christians who you could say they think of the guru tattva as only can be Jesus Christ. And Catholics, it has to be the Catholic Jesus. And, you know, Protestants, it has to be the Protestant Jesus, whatever. But it's like, clearly, as they tap into that, they're getting some of that juice. But then they're also getting all of the other stuff too. And so it's like, I talk about the guru tattva as like that principle of awakened energy that we can tap into, that is the principle of transformation. It really is the principle of annihilation, but that like, it's not self-improvement. In other words, it's a force of that, as Ram Dass would say, becoming nothing.
Yeah. Right.
And, yeah. And the, you know, we have to be supremely creative today, and open, because it's not like we're running the show, but just like open for that guru tattva to come in different ways.
Yeah.
Yesterday, and I don't think he'd mind me telling the story, but I ran into our friend John.
Yeah.
And we were at the skateboard park, and we were both punks back in the day. Well, I guess we still are, but anyway, we were talking about punk rock music, and I want his band to play at my 50th birthday party and all this stuff. And he said, you know, the craziest thing happened. He said, I have this friend from back in the day. He was a crazy guy. He was like a crazy partier guy. I hadn't talked to him in years. And he called me up. This is John's telling the story. His friend calls him up and says, hey, John, I had this weird dream last night that Ventura was on fire. There was an apocalypse or something. Ventura was on fire. And out of the flames came your guy. What's he called? Ram Dass or something? That guy? He's like, Ram Dass? He's like, yeah, Ram Dass came out of the fire. And he said, do you know John? And I said, yeah. And he said, I have a message for John. Tell John you have to throw it or you'll never break it. And if you never break it, you'll never know how to fix it. Tell him that.
Get out.
And so then John, this was a while, this is a long time ago. And then John says to me, he's like, I don't know what it means. He's like, I Googled it. You know, John, he's like a supremely like innocent sort of a person. He's like, I don't know what it means. But in that moment, that was what I needed to hear. This was just yesterday.
No.
And I was like, I understand it. I was like, that's a profound teaching about creativity and taking chances and like not living too carefully. And it's like, you know, that when we're open in that way, It's like John is so open that somebody that he hasn't talked to in years becomes an open vessel for grace to flow. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It boggles the mind when we're open, how the Guru Tattva, it's actually ever present. And it's just the sadhaka's role to be more and more open to it.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, I've got a couple of things to say about that. It's a two-way street. That being open is the thing that we can do, even though ultimately there is, of course, the non-duals who say, there's nothing to do. Doing what we are doing some practice and remaining open, understanding every moment is filled with possibility. Mm. At the same time, the fact that John's old friend, so to me, you're talking about Guru Tattva, and I'm talking about Saguna. There is no doubt in my mind, because Ram Dass, there's nothing he's doing on his own. Zero. Yeah. Never did. I mean, obviously he did bullshit human stuff that he had to wake up from, and that happened, and he worked with it better than anybody that I ever saw, particularly a full-on stroke where you almost die. Mm. But I know that this is nothing but Maharaji. So whoever that old friend is and whatever he needed, because Ram Dass is that trusted factor for so many in the West, and whatever John, like just hearing that is a faith thing. Holy shit, how does this guy? And then there's you. You got your own thing going.
I feel like I shared it. I don't remember how, but immediately it became something that was like a really important teaching for other people too, that are like within my sphere. It's so interesting.
Yeah. Hey, how it works is phenomenal. Hey, I wanted to talk about the Saint Kabir, actually, because you brought it up, and I know how important a figure he is. And I don't even know if you know this, but Maharaji quoted very few, because he just wasn't like that. He didn't teach, so he wasn't going on about anything.
Yeah.
But Kabir, Kabir was right in there. And tell us a little bit of Kabir's story, because it's a great story with his guru and everything. You want to tell the story?
Yeah. Like Kabir's actual story about him? Yeah.
Who he is, when it was, I think it's what century, maybe 15th, 16th or something?
16th century. 16th. And, the stories, the actual hagiography of him is like a little bit murky. Because how it is in India, when there's a saint, then all of this masala gets put onto the story. But, what makes the most sense is that he was born into a weaver family, families that make rugs and weave cloth and stuff like that. And in Varanasi, and generally those people were Muslim. And also, if Kabir was his birth name, that would typically be a Muslim name in that time. So a lot of, especially the Muslims, say that he was born Muslim.
Yeah.
Then there's stories that, he appeared in a giant lotus and a baby and was adopted by a Muslim family and whatever. For, all of that masala goes on there. But it just seems like he was a young Muslim man who had a deep yearning and a deep mumukshutva, as it's called, really wanted to attain the truth. And so the story goes is that he wanted to take initiation with the Hindu guru Ramananda. No, he wasn't Ramananda.
No, I think that's true. It is Ramananda. Yeah.
Maybe it was Ramananda.
Yeah.
I'm blanking, but anyway, with the Hindu guru. And so what he did is he would go and he would sneak by the ashram, which was on the Ghat, which is these steps that go down into the river.
In Benares.
In Benares, yeah. And And he would go and he would sneak there and he would, you know, whether he was like listening to teachings or he was just getting in the vibe or whatever it was. But the story goes that one day when he was there, Ramananda went down for his bath and tripped on him and called out the mantra Ram Ram as he was, you know, trying to not to fall down the steps. And that Kabir considered that to be his initiation, where he touched the guru's feet, you know, by the guru, like touching him with his feet. And then he got the mantra initiation. And, you know, you never know if these stories are historical or hysterical, but it's a sweet story. But he became known as a great Nirguni master who would weave his cloth and sing these ecstatic poems. And
I would have to say he's a real cross, right? I mean, he is totally Nirguna Saguna.
And he's, you know, he would give these profound teachings in a poetic form. And still to this day, his poems are, you know, quoted by great masters and just sung by school children. And, you know, it's an omnipresent sort of part of the Indian culture now, but his teachings have some of the most profound non-dual teachings in them.
Yeah.
In his poetry.
Do you, I don't know if you have it available to me. Well, it's the one that Maharaj used to quote. I walk through the town with all of its glory and objects, but none of it is, he's completely detached. Do you know that, that one?
I don't know it offhand, but you know, his, the number of different poems that are attributed to him now are, you know, like really myriad, but that's definitely sounds like a Kabir.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. I should have been more prepared and gotten that one, but you know what, guys? And gals, I'm going to get somebody to get, well, we're certainly going to introduce Kabir book that people can access. And we're certainly going to have that particular quote that I know Neem Karoli Baba used to use about being in the marketplace, but not of it.
And there's a great website too, if I can mention it.
Yeah.
That came out of the Kabir project that happened a few years ago. And it's a Hindi word. It's ajabshahar.com is it. And you know, I can send you that link and you can put it in the notes or whatever.
Definitely.
But it has a massive catalog of Kabir's poems, like full poems and couplets, you know, the little short two line poems. And I don't even know how many videos of contemporary folk singers singing the music. And beautiful translations and essays written about the poems. And I actually have one that I can read to
Please.
You if you're interested.
I am.
And this is a very typical Kabir. And what it says in English, and I really trust the translations on here too, because of course in translations there's always a fair amount of masala. It says, your better days have passed away. You didn't seek your guru. Why regret it now when the birds have eaten your harvest? That's the opening Doha couplet. And then it says, stay awake. A thief will steal into your town. Stay alert. A thief will sneak into your town. A thief will come one day. Death will come. No swords, cannons, or arrows will fly. He won't fire a gun. You won't see him come or go. Inside you, he'll roam around. Stay alert, a thief will come. He won't wreck any fort, raise any castle. He won't show you his form. He has no use for your city. He'll catch only you and take you away. Stay awake, a thief will come. Your wealth and riches, goods and treasures will be left behind, all stashed away. Your family and friends, brothers and kin will be left behind to stand and stare. Stay alert, a thief will come. Says Kabir, this land is deserted. No one here is yours. You came with your fist clenched, my friend. You'll go with your hands outstretched. Stay awake, a thief will come.
That's so great. I never.
And they say in India, like, kya baat hai. Yeah. Like what a, because, and this is the thing with so many of the great beings. This can be, he always talked about death, you know, the death will come. So like, do your thing now before you die. You know, one of his things says, the clay says to the potter, you need me today. That's true. But one day, don't be mistaken, I'll be needing you. Like the clay one day will be like on top of the potter. You know, so it's a very simple message just about, you know, death. But for the yogi who is seeking death in life, it's a poem about that too. And that, like, the thief then in that case isn't the death, but the thief is ignorance. The thief is getting allured. The thief is your ego's satisfaction. It's not going to take anything from you. It's going to be in you roaming around. It doesn't care about any of your stuff. It wants you. It's so, and then it ends with that thing. You came in with your hands clenched and you'll leave with them outstretched. Again, it's a double meaning. It means it's talking about the corpse, but it's also talking about the yogi who at some point their hands are. They say that Bhagavan Nityananda rarely closed his hands. And when you see pictures of him, his hands were always like this. It was some peculiar thing about him, but it makes me think of that.
Yeah. Wow. You got another one?
Sure. This
I love these Kabir poems. I mean, or just ecstatic poetry from India is phenomenal.
I know.
And then they turn it into bhajans too,
exactly. Two,
which are kirtan, repetition of God's name. Bhajan is a devotional poem set to music. There's incredible singers doing that.
I know. And it's like something that has not quite made its way into our Western, you know, we've embraced the kirtan, but the bhajans,
no,
there's just so many great teachings. And, you know,
it's because, of course, people don't understand it, you know, and have to have lyrics in front of you. But it's also because of Indian music. These are all based on, even if they're folk tunes, they're coming from ultimately from ragas and so on. And just, you know, all the grace notes and the quarter and half, you know, all that half tones. It's hard for a Western ear, actually.
Okay, so here's another one. It says, and again, it starts with like a short thing and then it goes into the main thing. So the short thing says, the Sadguru has explained this 1,000 times. The short tail of a sheep can't help you cross the river. With a false front, you conned the world and didn't look into yourself. Kabir says, greed drags you into endless cycles of death. And then it goes, this is one of his scolding poems. And he says, leave your charades, give up your fake postures. Oh, mind, be true in your practice. Give up your phony airs. Oh, heart, be a real fakir, a real yogi. Hari isn't found by taking dips. Anyone can take baths. Fish bathe daily in the water, yet can't get rid of their smell. Leave your charades. Hari isn't found by growing dreadlocks. Anyone can grow hair. Bears in the jungle have thick hair, yet roam around aimlessly. Leave your charades. Hari isn't found by shaving your hair either. Anyone can wield a razor. Cross-dressers shave off their hair, yet wander from door to door. Leave your charades. Kabir says, listen, seekers. Listen with full attention. One who doesn't give up his airs gets hauled to the city of death. Leave your charades.
Oh, God. That's a, you know who this, all of a sudden it occurs to me that somebody who I love so much, a great teacher, is Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. I'm not sure.
You know,
yeah, one of the great lamas of the last century. Uncompromising, just like that. Really think you're going to wait and, you know, you have all of these lovely, this lovely family and friends and your work, and then bang, you're gone. You think that these people are going to give a shit about anything? 3 weeks, maybe they'll think about you. That's it. So do something to allow yourself to transition through the bardos properly. Yeah. I like it.
It's so, and when you hear, you know, we had a group of Kabir singers, they're dear friends of mine from India, come through and they did a concert here in the house. And, you know, even though they speak very little English and my Hindi is almost functionally illiterate, I mean, like I could barely speak Hindi, bonding over some of these ideas, it's like the deepest level that you can connect with another human being in a certain way. And there's just such love that comes as a result of it. I mean, even though there's this imagery of death and you're going to get hauled to the city of death and all of that, it's like when we really enter into even like the charnel ground kind of meditation, the result is a lightness of heart and like an absence of bullshit that allows us to really love each other and let go of all the things that don't matter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, the power of ecstatic expression of non-duality, right? Which is a bit of an oxymoron, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But to me, that I feel so graced that we come out of that, exactly that tradition. That's why Kabir was obviously Maharaji. You know, I mean, it says like you go, we used to go in the gate of Khyentse to see him. And it says when it described, you know, this is the ashram of Neem Karoli, Hanuman Ashram. It was, it said, this is the non-dual Advait. It had Advait, which is highly unusual, supposedly a completely, you know, bhakti yoga thing. No, there's no Advait.
Yeah.
But that's why Kabir represents that. That's the beauty, the real beauty.
Yeah. I mean, because that's the thing with bhakti, is that bhakti can, you know, when you're talking about like, where do we stand? Do we stand in the head or do we stand in the heart? Yeah. One way that we stand in the head is when we become religious or dogmatic. And, you know, there are a lot of bhakti traditions that are just religions and dogma. And, you know, like I've had so many arguments over the years with, you know, people that are like dualistic bhakti yogis about the idea of like merging with God. It's like, no, there's no merging. It's like, no, you're not Krishna. I was like, yeah, no, actually I am Krishna. So are you. No, I'm not Krishna. Krishna is supreme. Well, yeah, Krishna is supreme and so are we, but we're just showing up like these two schmucks talking about Krishna right now. But that's the and that's the profound thing about your lineage in particular is that it's really radically non-dual in the sense that it's both non-dualistic ultimately, but also embraces all the saguna stuff and all of the technically dualistic stuff too. I was talking with Locke Kelly. Do you know Locke?
Yeah, I love him. Yeah.
Yeah, me too. I was talking to him and for a while he was my therapist for a minute when we were in New York and it was so cool. And I just remember telling him, it's like, yeah, I get non-dual thing. I just love Bandaras. You know, like, I get the non-dual thing, but I just love, you know, Hanuman and, you know, like crying and like even in Tukaram Maharaj, one of the Maharashtrian saints used to say, yeah, I built my house in the void. That was one of his poems. and Maharashtra and Abhanga were the bhajans. And one of his things is I built my house in the void. Such a beautiful Abhanga. I wish I had a translation of it right here. But he said, but I love to be in duality just so that I can worship the Lord. Mm-hmm. And it just because it's so sweet. And then in bhakti, even the pain of separation becomes this mm-hmm. wonderful currency, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And that's what
exactly.
That's what I love about what has come through Maharaji, because it has all of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it mm-hmm. totally welcomes the person that is a total dilettante and just wants to have like a Hanuman sticker on their car or whatever and have a little bit of, you know, spiritual taste in their life. Totally welcome. And it also welcomes the Ram Dass and the Raghu and the deep yogis as well. It's so cool.
Hey,
all in one satsang.
Yeah. Hey, how about, because I know you are talking to and teaching meditation in all of mm-hmm. this, and I thought maybe you could you just lead a, you know, a couple of minute little thing that would be good. And I say, not just because we're at the end of the podcast, but also we're in times when there is such fireballs that get thrown at us and the instant reactivity is so large in so many ways. Even if you're not even going any place, you know, that one moment when the frustration level just reaches its breaking point. How can we just, take us through a something that we can repeat for ourselves in moments such as that?
Yeah. Just looking across my space here at my puja and looking at Maharaji actually and just listening. So if we just close our eyes and or just soften our eyes, even relax into the space where we're sitting and take some breaths that are sweet and sweet energetically. The message that I'm getting is to just feel inside and feel any way in which we are clenching ourselves and any way that we're punishing ourselves. Anything that we need to forgive ourselves for in this moment. And just let those things go completely. And let ourselves be loved. Take away all charges are dropped. All chains are released. And just let ourselves be loved the way that we deserve to be loved. That was it. That was what he said to do.
Yeah, that's great. Wonderful. I like, all the charges are dropped. That's a good one.
Because we have enough things on top. We have enough things to actually deal with. And then we put so many trips on ourselves and hold ourselves so in jail, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, the judgmental level of our minds is extraordinary. Yeah. Extraordinary. Yeah. Thank you so much, Harsha.
Thank you, Raghu. Keep up the good work. And hopefully we'll see each other in the flesh before too long.
Yeah. We live like 7 minutes from each other. It's sick. Well, we're getting there. I think we're moving in the right direction.
For sure.
So, yeah, definitely. And everybody, so everything we've been talking about will be available and linked up in the show notes. and including access to David's work, Harshad's work, and
One of the things I did during COVID is I started a little independent guided meditation platform. It's called the Big Heart Meditation Club.
Oh, great.
And it's, you know, $10 a month and you can try it out for free. And it's just got a bunch of my guided meditations on there that people can access. All kind of different ones.
Oh, great.
I'll have to record that one and put it on there.
Okay, great. Great, great, great. I'll also make one little announcement that I haven't made before on behalf of Love, Serve, Remember Foundation. We're putting out, because we were talking about music and we were talking about kirtan and bhajan and devotional poetry. And so Krishnadas and I, many, many years ago, recorded our mentor, K.K. Shah, who really was tantamount to much of what you hear from Jai Gopal and Krishnadas and so on. I mean, he just is so important to us. He left about a year ago, right after Ram Dass. So we're putting it out. We're putting the a digipack out. It'll be downloads and all that stuff. And by the time this podcast appears, it will be available. And you can go look at ramdass.org into the shop or the store. Yeah. And I'll have to, you, I think, will appreciate it most especially, David. Yeah.
So good to elevate these OGs, you know, the like Indians that, we get this stuff from.
Yeah.
It's so important.
Yeah. And that's a bunch of my life work, actually, movies that we're creating around just these people. So, well, thank you again.
Well, God bless you, Raghu.
Thank you. And everybody, we'll see you again on Mind Rolling. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and catch all of the incredible. We have this great thing from Ram Dass and Alan Watts in one podcast that's up there now, by the way. Check it out. See you later. See you next week.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.